Let's open in prayer. Father, thanks for the opportunity to be together tonight and for the opportunity to consider this incredible responsibility and privilege we have of raising children and having lives that honor you and model what it is to follow you. So I pray that you will teach each of us whatever it is you have for us tonight. In Christ's name, amen. Let me just say the simplest form what we want to accomplish tonight, in case you fall off asleep at some point, you will have heard sort of where we're headed. And that is, we spend a lot of our time doing marriage counseling. And we talk to couples, and often we say, well, where did you see this happening or starting? And you start going back, and it was because they said, well, I probably shouldn't have married who I married. And, well, how did you meet? Well, we probably were where we shouldn't have been. And you start going back. And so basically what we're going to try to convince you of tonight is if you want your child to marry well, it starts in about fourth grade at the latest. And if you don't start with this in the fourth grade, there's a good chance they will not marry well. Because who they hang around, if they hang out with good people who love the Lord in the fourth grade, they will in junior high. They go to high school, they do. They go to college, they do. And there's the pool of people that they select from, you see? So it isn't a guarantee there won't be any issues. But that's where we want to sort of walk, and what's our role in modeling for that. These are different times, though, are they not, for us to raise kids? I mean, it's changed. Some friends of ours who moved went to had a doctor's appointment with their 10-year-old. And the 10-year-old came out and said that he had been in the doctor, and he was telling his 12-year-old brother about this, and said, a new doctor, and the doctor looked at my private parts. And the 12-year-old said, why did they do that? 10-year-old says, I don't know. I think they were checking for erectile dysfunction. And he didn't know at all what that was. But these are different days, right? Why did that 10-year-old think that? Because this family loves sports. And you hear about Viagra, you know, 80,000 times in a weekend. So these are tough, tough times to raise our kids. They're being exposed to a lot, and we want to talk about how we can help them along that journey. Let me turn you on. Oh, if it Thanks. Were that easy.
Part of what we also want to really convince you of tonight is that our attitude towards marriage, our belief that this is a covenant relationship designed by God to ultimately affect his purposes on earth. It's a revelation of himself and of the unity of the Godhead. It's so much more than about us, which is what we've been sold all these years, that marriage is pretty much about me and my happiness. We want to convince you that helping your children understand that marriage is actually about God and about his purposes. And in order to do that, we kind of have to really believe it ourselves. It means that in our marriages, the messages that we're sending our children are really consistent with Scripture. It's no surprise that we live in a disposable age on many levels, and I would just want to tell you that far more toxic than the plastics that we're putting into our environment is a belief that marriage is disposable, that we pretty much can come and go as we please. This article came out on the internet 2 weeks ago. The announcement that Al and Tipper Gore are separating after 40 years of marriage has captured the attention of the American public to a rather surprising degree. After all, divorce is hardly uncommon these days, and the Gores are famously part of the baby boom generation, the generation of couples with the highest divorce rate in history. Well, let me say what caught my attention on this article is the title of it, is Ever After Just Too Long. Okay, so continuing on, couples who married in the 1970s are the greatest divorcing generation of all time. This person from McGill University acknowledged sadness in the Gores' announcement of their pending divorce, but suggested that we should actually be celebrating, quote, how much optimism they now have for the rest of their lives. Writing at the New Republic, Michelle Cottle was even more cheery, arguing that it's just fine that middle-aged couples divorce. I mean, 40 years of marriage is, quote, an impressive chunk of time to spend together. The expectation that marriage means staying together into the next phase of adult life is actually unreasonable. The story of the Gores, she insisted, is, quote, a classically American tale with its themes of hope and promise and new beginnings. They go on to say, marriage, quote, was actually designed for a time when people died in their 40s and 50s after raising children together. A retired divorce attorney continues the dialogue by saying, actually, now we're living longer, we're healthier, and couples are bored with one another. We actually have to ask ourselves the question, is ever after too long? What was horrifying to me in this, most of all, was the statement that marriage was designed at a time when couples only lived into their 40s and 50s. I thought, well, number one, a completely biblically ignorant person who doesn't actually realize that it's from the beginning of time. And by the way, according to scripture, some of those guys lived 800 and 900 years.
I mean, you talk about a commitment. Make your choice wisely.
But I think what's so sobering about this is that I feel we live in a time where if it's printed, it must be true. And so this just adds to a growing belief that marriage is disposable, that it's really unrealistic to think that you can make a commitment that can last for life and all the rest. If we allow the culture to shape our view of marriage, it will trickle down to our kids. And on the contrary, if we continue to live before them with a bold proclamation of the goodness of God's design in marriage, which doesn't mean trouble-free marriages, and it actually doesn't mean that there will therefore never be a divorce in the Christian community. We'll just say it right at the front end that we understand that divorce is part of our culture. And in the Bible, it's actually referred to a place to be the lesser of two evils. That's why God granted divorce, because of the hardness of men's heart. So we understand that even some of you in this room have experienced the tragedy of divorce in your own life, and it hasn't been because that's what you had hoped for or signed up for or anything else. So please hear everything tonight through the lens of the reality that God is going to be enough for whatever our situations are. But for those of us who are currently in marriages, we're just going to encourage you to do everything you can to convince the next generation that marriage for a lifetime is a really good thing because of who God is, not necessarily because who we are.
Well, we've got 8 points in this outline that we're just going to sort of power through here, and hopefully these will touch off some good discussion for you. First is have a plan for them, for your children. Psalm 127, 1, unless the Lord builds a house, its builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stand guard in vain. Do you have a plan for your kids? Do you know what you want your kids to look like at 18 from a standpoint of a spiritual development? We moved back to New England in 1991. And one of the first things we realized was in New England, people are really serious about education. They enroll children literally before they're born and get in waiting lines. They get in the right preschools. They go to the right private elementary school, boarding school, whatever it is, prep school, because they want their children to go to Harvard or Yale or, you know, some Ivy League school. That's not true as a rule in California. You know, how's the surf today? Is the sun shining? Education is fine, but it's nothing like it is on the East Coast. My first sermon in New England, I preached, I think you folks are more interested that your children get into Harvard than heaven. I only preached there once for some reason. But it's true. Because if those kids said, you know, I don't feel like going to school, the parents would say, you're going. I've enrolled you. This is what your track is. But if our kids, I don't feel like going to church, what can I do? And we let our kids chart their own track for their spiritual development, where we would never do that educationally. So we can't force our children's spiritual decisions, but we should have a daggone good plan to do everything in our power to help them develop. And so often it's just that we don't have it. Our verse that we have used as a couple is, I have no greater joy than to know that my children are walking in the truth. How you honestly finish that sentence will determine how you live your life. If you have no greater joy than to know that your kids are great athletes, that will be your priority. I know no greater joy than my kids are popular, that's what you'll do. I have no greater joy than that I have a great golf game, that's how you'll live. No greater, whatever you honestly finish that with. But if we honestly say, I have no greater joy than that my children are walking in truth, it will revolutionize how we start making decisions for life. The print didn't come out.
This is really funny. Our outline, my words are supposed to be in red tonight, but they're actually in yellow, so I actually can't see them. So
it'll be a shorter talk tonight than normal, but this is where we talk about milestones and stuff.
And so as you consider the plan you have for kids, and some of you are saying, of course I have a plan, but I'm going to say that by and large, we enter this parenting thing just assuming you just have kids and that something comes very naturally, and you just sort of, I feel... Oftentimes, as couples, we're just trying to keep up with life. We're not necessarily living very intentionally. And we're just going to suggest that you take some time out, even before you leave the island this weekend, to think through, are we being intentional and diligent to follow plans for our kids? And I'm not now talking about this ultra-high control life necessarily. I'm just saying, do you know where you're going? That old Chinese proverb that says, if you aim at nothing, you'll surely hit it. I mean, the studies that they've done on people who produce always have, they've been good planners. They have really set out with some markers on the horizon to shoot for. So whether it is milestones, Paul talked a little bit about that from the book, Raising a Trailblazer, that at certain points along the journey, you're celebrating in specific ways to press certain values. Whatever it is, make sure that you're thinking ahead as much as you can, keeping ahead of your kids in the journey. Okay, we can go on.
Okay, I'm just helping you a little bit, trying to write out some of it. Secondly, help them see your delight in Christ and his word. Philippians 4:9, whatever you have learned or received or heard from me or seen in me, put into practice, and the God of peace will be with you. Wow. Are we willing to say that to our kids? Whatever you've seen in me, do what I do. And now, a lot of this has to do with this whole area. Are they going to see delight in our relationship with Christ? Are they going to see delight in our relationship with his word? You know, I love a lot of adults, you know, who will say to their son, when you get as old as I am, I hope you have as much joy in the Lord as I do. The day I accepted Jesus was the best decision I ever made. You know, what kids are going to want to do that? You know, if you've got the joy of the Lord in your heart, would you mind notifying your face? You know, there should be something in us that is vibrant. Not hilarious, but vibrant. And too many of us are not living vibrantly, so why should our kids? Ray Johnson, who's one of our mentors in youth work, says he believes the number one reason that high schoolers walk away from the faith, and it's 80 to 90% do, it's because they look at their parents and say, why would I want to live like that? It doesn't mean we're perfect, doesn't mean we have to be perfect, but they need to see us have a vital relationship with Christ.
Because we really can't pass on what we don't have. You know, the old saying that more is caught than taught is no place is that more true than with our kids. They will not be convinced by our words. They're going to be convinced by our lives. And that's where we have such a great opportunity. The most natural discipleship happens actually in our homes with parents who are sold out, who are all in for Jesus. There's nothing more convincing to a child that it's worth signing up to follow Jesus than seeing their parents live that out. And you realize there's no parent lives that out perfectly. So that's not what we're talking about here. I think some of us check out at this point and say, oh, great, we've already blown it. There's really no hope. Maybe one of the most important things that we model for our kids is the humility to confess when we've blown it, especially when we've blown it against them. We've had far too many high school and college students at this camp who have said to us, you know what, my parents actually have never apologized for anything they've done. I think my parents really think they've done everything right. Well, we happen to know a lot of their parents, and we're sure their parents know that they haven't done everything right. But this is the typical apology of a parent, and I think oftentimes in the Christian community, we rationalize that it's okay to do this. I'm really sorry that I lost my cool with you. I never should have yelled at you that way. But if you hadn't, and the minute the but is inserted in that sentence, you've canceled the apology and you have shifted the blame. And we are so good at that, aren't we? We always can find excuses, but you realize then what we've modeled is the great American pastime of blame shifting. We never have to take responsibility for anything we do as long as we have a good enough excuse. And so we're shocked then when our kids grow up and they do the same thing. We can see it in them. We just can't see it in ourselves. But I'll tell you, this modeling for delight in God's word, this is the great adventure. This is such an amazing journey that we have on this earth. Having a personal relationship with the God of this universe who knows us by name, who gives us the hope, who's promised to be enough for us. There is nothing better that we can pass on to our kids than that, if we really believe it ourselves. And I will tell you, our kids are watching. One of my favorite stories comes from a family that we have mentored in New England. They told us that when their 10-year-old got an iPod for Christmas, so excited about it, sadly, he forgot about it when he put it in the pants, his pocket of his cargo pants, and then tossed them in the laundry. And in case you don't know, iPods don't wash. So it came out of the washing machine. It wasn't working. They took it to the local Apple store to see if there was any hope for this iPod, and they were told by the genius at the counter, no, iPods that have been washed cannot be resurrected. That's kind of like the end of the road for them. So he said, but I'll tell you what. He said, it's so new, and I mean, really. He said, I can't replace it for you because I know what happened to it because you've told me. But if you go to another Apple store and tell them that you don't really know why it's not working, this 2-month-old iPod, they'll replace it for you. And when the dad told us the story, we were waiting with eagerness to hear what he would say. And I could just picture this 10-year-old standing at the counter, his eyes growing larger, like, this is about as cool as it could possibly be. I'm going to get a new iPod after all. And his dad said, you know what? And how awkward is the position? Have we not been there where somebody's trying to help you out? Oh, my goodness. I had more women offer DVDs for us to bootleg when our kids were, anyway. So he just took a deep breath and he said, thank you so much for being willing to help us. I know that that's what is in your heart, but we do know why the iPod isn't working, so we will just replace it. And when he told us that story, I thought, you know what, that 10-year-old kid is going to hear a lot of sermons on integrity. He's going to hear a lot of lessons in youth group on how important it is to be honest, but none of them will have the impact that those 10 minutes will have the whole rest of his life to know that his dad loved the law of the Lord enough to make an expensive decision that would uphold his integrity. That's the kind of stuff we're talking about. That's the kind of stuff that says, this is right and this is good, even when it costs at times.
You see, what we're doing already is we're helping our children start to love the Lord just by seeing us. Because when they're young, they do imitate. They imitate what we do, even when we don't think they're going to imitate.
Oh, my goodness. That just reminds me of when Carrie and Lisa were 4 and 2, and Lisa was learning how to use the potty. I'm in the kitchen, and I hear them calling my name, so I go back to the bathroom to walk in on this scene. Carrie is on the throne reading a Good Housekeeping magazine, and Lisa was on the little potty chair, and she had an Osterizer cookbook upside down that she was apparently reading. And I said, what did you need, girls? And Carrie said, we just need more mazagines in here. And, you know, the scene is just one of those moments where you're thinking to yourself, wow, I really never set out to teach them that the library annex was right in this room. But our children are a lot like your kids, and they pick up what we don't necessarily want them to pick up because they naturally imitate.
Third point is to be there for them. John 1:14 says, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. You know, this is really tough to be there for our kids because we're really busy. We've got all sorts of things going on, all sorts of pressures in order to live in the house we live in. We're both working full time, and there's so many pressures. But let us just challenge you that your kids need you. And they need you all the way until they leave your house. At least our view is that we felt our kids needed us more when they were in junior high and senior high than they did when they were young. And we hear so many parents say, well, I need to be there for my kids when they're young. But once they get in school, especially junior high, then I can go back full-time work, da-da-da-da. We don't want to be at all insensitive to the economic times and the need for some of us to both be working outside the home. But let's make sure we're working outside the home for necessities. Because our kids don't need big houses. They don't need neat cars. I've never heard, we do this every year, I've never heard our staff say, the thing I love most when I think about memories is that we had a 6,000 square foot house. Best thing about our family was we drove a Beamer. All we hear is, I remember the vacation. My dad and mom were there. We had this. It's all relationship. And you don't have a relationship unless you're there. Julie, our youngest daughter, when she was playing sports in high school, she and Lisa both played three-season sports. And they're playing lacrosse with a gal, and the gal turned 16. And Julie came home and told us that for her 16th birthday, this girl had been given a brand new BMW by her parents. And so she told us a story, and we said, well, that's interesting, which means dream on, sweetheart. So so then it was 2 weeks later, and she came home, and she said, you know, we were playing lacrosse today, and the Miss BMW looked up into the stands at the two of you and said to me, I'd give it all back if my parents were ever there. She said, I played three-season sports for 4 years. They've never been. At one game. We said, well, it was either a Beamer or go to your game, so we went to your game. So, but you know, again, not to minimize how difficult this is, but most of us can make it happen if we make it a priority to be at our kids' stuff. I was on staff at a church, so there's a little more flexibility, and I will grant that. But I don't think like logically, I don't think sequentially. So what I had to do was give the girl's schedule to my assistant when it was printed. And I said, you just put that in the calendar all the way through. I go in on Tuesday, say, what do I have today? You have counseling here, you have staff meeting here. 2 o'clock, you need to leave to go to Pingree because your girls have a game. I'd come back in, I'd work till midnight, whatever it takes, because it's really important to be there for your kids. They don't all of you say, oh, thanks so much for coming. It means so much to me. Very seldom will you get that. Don't parent off cues from your kids. Parent by doing what's right. And they need you there. So think through when you're making your priorities, is this something that's going to allow me to be there for my kids, and especially as they get in junior high and high school?
I think one of the helpful questions to ask at every season of life is, what is unique to this season that is not going to be here in the next season? I think you kind of try to work backwards from that. I took it in chunks of like 10 years. Okay, in 10 years, what is not going to be available to me? What will I not be able to invest in 10 years from now that I can currently invest in? And I'll tell you, my personal position on this is that everything except life itself will probably be there in one manner, shape, or form in the next season. So I made a pretty tough decision when Paul started seminary in 1991, the whole reason we moved to New England, found out that I could go for free. I could get a master's degree for free, and I am the queen of free. So this is like made for me. I go up to register and find out that I actually have to be full-time enrolled if I'm going to take advantage of the grant. Our kids were 6, 8, and 11. We had just gotten back to New England. And I'll tell you, I said to the registrar, why can't I just take one class? That's what I was planning to do and just work at this master's in counseling. She said, well, that's how the grant is written. I'm really sorry. And as I walked down the hill back to our dorm on the beautiful grounds of Gordon Conwell, by the time I reached our house, I knew that I was going to walk away from a free master's degree because that was going to be available to me 10 years from then, and my kids were not. I just knew that I was not going to be able to do justice to school and to our kids. Fast forward to 2003, our youngest child's graduating from high school. We're moving into the empty nest phase and launching Home Improvement Ministries, the ministry that we're currently in running. And we met with a professor from Gordon Conwell who said, you both need to have your Doctor of Ministry degree in marriage and family therapy in order to do this nationwide. He said, New England, they know you, but when you go around the country, you're going to need your doctorates. He said, you both have your master's, don't you? And Paul said, well, very smugly, oh, yes, I do. And I said, well, I don't. And I just recounted that little story to him. And without missing a beat, he said, well, you probably don't know this, but we can invite one student into each of our doctoral cohorts who don't have the prerequisite master's, but whose life experience would substitute for that. So we would like you to come directly into the program.
Really ticked me off. I mean, I all that work. No, that's not true. And very happy for her.
And I want to tell you, it was a moment from heaven for me. I just felt like God peeled back the curtains of heaven and he said, I saw what you did. The decision you made in 1991, it was the right decision at the right time. And I'm now making a way for you to be equipped to do what I want you to do in this next season of your life. I don't tell you that because I think God is going to do that for everybody in the exact same way, but I want you to have the same exact confidence that he's paying attention to what you're doing and he's going to make a way for you to accomplish his purposes for you at the right time. I think we have so much pressure from our society that says if you don't get it right now, you will have missed out and it's not going to come back around. I just want to tell you the only things that aren't going to come back around are your kids. They grow up and they leave and then you're into a new season of life. Don't miss what's before you now.
Fourthly, give them convictions. Genesis 39:9 says, this talking about Joseph, no one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? He wasn't going to get caught. It was a perfect situation. Everything looked good, but he wouldn't do it because it was a sin against God. In our fine state of Massachusetts, this just came across the waves earlier this summer. In elementary students in Provincetown, Massachusetts, can now acquire condoms at school, and parents can be assured their children will receive proper instruction about the use of these condoms. Children as young as grade one will be able to ask for condoms without parental consent, thanks to a new policy recently approved by the town's school council. The policy, and listen to this, requires students talk with a school nurse or counselor before receiving condoms. So that's comforting that your first grader will be able to discuss it with somebody before they get their condom. There are no age restrictions for distribution. And then listen to this. Also, schools will not honor requests from parents who don't want their children to get condoms. Now, the thing that is so critical in raising children, they'll make good decisions and eventually choose good mates and make good mates, is that they're people of conviction. Now, if you're fading off, hear this real clearly. This isn't a problem if your kids have convictions. See, they're not forcing anybody to have a condom. They're not forcing anybody to use a condom. They're just making it available. But if your child has convictions, that they're not going to be sexually involved, they're not going to be, then who cares? You see what that is? The world is never going to get better. I'm not against us working and working through the political systems and all this, but darkness is always going to be darkness. The only way our kids are going to make it through this world, whether it's Christian school, homeschool, public school, no school, whatever it is convictions. And that's our role, from the earliest age, to help them understand why we make decisions, who God is, why his word is true, why it is good. I'll never forget driving Carrie and to the airport, Boston Logan Airport, when she went away for her freshman year to school in Germany. And looking in the back rearview mirror, seeing our three girls, I just realized it's done. I mean, Carrie's going away. She's not calling to say, can I go to this movie? Can I go with these people? Can I do this activity? It's her. If she doesn't have convictions now, my role is essentially over. Doesn't mean we don't have continue, but it's theirs. So why do you need to have a plan? Because it's critical. When they walk out the door, you want them to make good decisions, right? Not to get on the alcohol thing again, but let me just say, we were aghast at what happened at 9/11, were we not? 3,000 people lost their lives. Every 2 years on college campuses, more people, students, lose their lives through alcohol. And we're still advertising for it. See, our kids need to have convictions. They're going into places that are tough. So that's our role, to help them have convictions.
And let's just remember that our convictions are revealed by our lifestyle choices. So you're standing at Disneyland, getting ready to pay admission, and your 12-year-old is very tiny. And she's half price if she's still 10. And so you say, yes, I've got three children under the age of 11. Because isn't God honored that we've saved him some money? I mean, after all, Disney's a ripoff. They make plenty of money off of other people, right? It's those kind of decisions. It's how do we respond to authority in our own lives? How do our lifestyle choices reveal the convictions that we have? We may be policing our children and what they watch on television and not really paying that much attention to the fact that we have the television on a lot for our own thing. It's just sports. I mean, really, or it's just the, is it H&G? This HGTV, thank you. That's good stuff. Our kids can only watch it a half an hour a day, but we have it pretty much going all the time in our room. Or we have to think through, what are we modeling for them in terms of the convictions that we say we believe? Because really, how we walk is going to convince us that those convictions are the ones that are worth living by.
And we want them, again, to see that walking with conviction is a good thing. These aren't, we're beating them down with these rules. One of my favorite illustrations comes from Joe White, who says in one of his books, he talked about his dog named Champ, and he says, if Champ has a sock that I have and I want it, I can yell at Champ, say, drop that sock, I can pull that sock, Champ will not let go. But if I take a piece of meat out of the refrigerator and hold it in my hand, Champ drops the sock. And he makes, I think, a profound illustration. He says, most Christian parents parent by yelling at Champ. That's bad, don't do that, stop doing that. And Champ just holds on, instead of showing them something way, way better. If we would say yes to Jesus, our kids would not have to have us say no nearly as much. Do you see that? Now that comes into the next point five, give them a love for the church. You see what's happening now? We're starting to move from our convictions that we teach them. Now let's make sure we're moving them in the pools of people that love Jesus. Now, that doesn't mean we don't have relationships with people outside the church that don't know Jesus, but our primary friends, our best friends, are people inside, right? Good friends don't ask you to do bad things, right? So we're surrounding with good people. One thing is making sure they're having a good church experience. Hebrews 10:25 says that we are not to stop going to church. Don't stop assembling with God's people. Psalm 121, I was, what's that word? Glad. Is this what your kids say when you get up and say, time to go to church? They go, Yahoo! They should be. It says, I was glad when they said we're going into the house of the Lord. It is critical because I think one of the reasons our young adults are doing so poorly is they don't have a good church experience. They may go to InterVarsity, may go to Crusade, may do stuff in college, but they get out, they haven't gone to church. Church is God's institution. And we need to have our kids loving church. For some of you, this means change churches. And your adolescents need to be given a lot of input in where you go to church. You may love it, but if your kids are dying, you got to look for a church that's vital where the preacher preaches with energy. They connect. Their youth group is good. They're doing stuff. Because if you don't care for it, you can go home and listen to R.C. Sproul or listen to anybody else. They won't. You got one shot with your kids. Now make this important to them. I love one of my mentors said when he was in junior high, he came home and says, Dad, I'm not going to go to church anymore. It's boring. His dad said, well, son, where are you going to be living then? Because we go to church. That is a solid priority for us. I like sports. Our girls are all athletes, so this is not down on sports. We, as we said, have a weekly Bible study with the couples from New England Patriots, which, by the way, 80% of NFL players within 2 years are divorced, bankrupt, or unemployed. Most of them, all three. 2 years of leaving the league, after leaving the league. And a lot of the players are dead who are playing in football on the line just because of what it's doing to their body. So here's my deal. I hear so often parents say, oh, we'd love to be in church, but our kids play soccer on Sunday. Or they have baseball. You know what I'd love for here? Ah, oh, we'd love for our kids to play soccer, but that's on Sunday. We go to church. It's a statement of priority. Now, again, I'm not down on sports, but let me just say something real honestly. Your kids aren't that good. They're not going anywhere, most of them. So why are you going at a frenetic pace to have them have some coach who probably isn't helpful in lifestyle modeling and take them out of church? I'm not dogmatic about it, but I do think you need to think about it because church and a relationship with the Lord is going to take them to the next generation. Sports is not.
And please hear that
and
we're not
balancing the comments will be my wife.
Yeah, we definitely aren't saying that it's an either or. Either your kids can be in sports or they can't. But I do want to throw out a challenge to you. In New England, there's a town near ours called Reading. And the parents got together and they said, you know what, we don't like all these youth sports programs that are happening on Sunday morning. I mean, you realize that that's a relatively new phenomenon in the last probably three decades. Prior to that, even stores were closed on Sunday. Some of you are old enough to remember Blue Laws. The parents in this town said, we don't want every Sunday wrecked by sports. Reading is not a Christian town, let me assure you. And I think most of the people that pushed for this were not necessarily evangelical Christians, but they're family people. There are a lot of strong family lines in New England. So they got together and they proposed to their selectmen that they would have a town ban on youth sports programs that they couldn't start before 12 o'clock on Sunday. And it passed. So if you play in the town of Reading, you will not have an opportunity to play sports on Sunday morning. Some of us need to lead campaigns in our own towns to protect the Sabbath in some measure or form that we can impact.
And then help them have good friends. This follows out of, hopefully, good churches, does it not? Proverbs 12:5 says, the plans of the righteous are just, but the advice of the wicked is deceitful. 1 Corinthians 15:33, do not be misled. Bad company corrupts good character. Wow. Now, so your children are getting older, and I'm thinking especially here, junior high and high school, and most parents say, hey, but I can't control who my kids' parent, who my kids' friends are. Why not? Here's the way you do it. You say, you cannot play with that person. You cannot see that person. You cannot be alone with that person. We had a very simple thing when our kids were young. If they came home from a place in worse shape than they left going to that place, we said, you can't go there again. Because you are being influenced negatively. You are not influencing positively. You're not strong enough. Now, that doesn't mean they wouldn't see that person. We'd invite them to our house, make your house a center. But you do have the control. I think we've given up way too soon. As long as your children are under your roof, you're the parent. Even if they have a job, even if they have keys, even if they have a car, it's not up to them what they wear, where they go, how late they stay up, who their friends are, what they're watching. You're the parent. Now, here's really clearly on this, rules without relationship produce rebellion. That's why you spend time with your kids. They need to know you're for them, you love them, you'd go to the ends of the earth for them, and you've set up some guidelines because you love them that much. We give up way too soon with our kids, and we let them. Now, what's happening? Who are they hanging around with now? They're friends who are not God-honoring friends. You see what's happening? Where are they going to make decisions about who they marry? The people they're hanging with. So you want to help them hang with good people. And that's why church and being in a really good youth group is so important. Make sure they're hanging with good people.
I want to tell you two things. One is that as much conventional wisdom tells us that teenagers are more influenced by their peers than they are by their families. The studies do not support that, right? Gabe and Carrie, you guys have been to a conference where they said that exact thing. The parents who are involved with their kids still have more influence in their kids' lives than their peers do. So don't check out, especially when you've got teenagers thinking, they don't want to hear from me anyway. They may not seem like they love to hear from you. They may not say to you, wow, thank you for that wisdom. That pretty much changed my life. But I'll tell you, keep listening and keep speaking into their lives. Secondly, as important as their peer pool is to make sure that they're surrounding themselves with healthy people, we want to encourage you to also have older people in their lives who are speaking into their lives in ways that you cannot. Now, I'm speaking about somebody who's maybe 4 or 5 years older than your kids. Some of you say to us, part of the reason you bring your families to Campus by the Sea is because you love the influence of our staff on your kids. And we love to hear that. And we love to believe that our staff are worth listening to. And I'll tell you from our own experience that having, and it all happened really here, staff who were 4 or 5 years older than our kids, especially when our kids got into those teenage years, boy, was that critical. I will never forget, we just moved to New England. One of our Campus by the Sea staff was attending Westmont College, but she came back to Gordon College for a consortium, you know, swap semester. And she asked me, she said, can I take Carrie out for, you know, a soda? Well, absolutely you can. Here's some money, here's the car, whatever you need. Spend time with her. And I'll never forget Carrie coming home from that time with Christina. She was so excited about her time. I said, well, what'd you guys talk about? She said, oh, it was amazing to hear Christina, Mom. She's so committed to purity. She's really not dating guys very much at all because she's waiting for the right person for her. She wants to marry somebody who really loves Jesus. And Carrie is talking with this sense that she just heard something she'd never heard before. In fact, I think she said as much. She said, like, this is so amazing, Mom. Like, I've never heard this. Well, can I just tell you, that's hard at that moment as a parent to stop yourself from saying, are you kidding me? Like, we've been spoon-feeding this to you since you were a child. Of course this isn't new to you. She's just reinforcing what... I just smiled and said, wow, Christina is extremely wise, isn't she? We loved having Christina influence our children, and we've loved over the years the other women that have spoken into their lives and the godly men who have. So be very intentional about getting those sort of people in your kid's life. If you think, oh, well, it was easy for you, you're at camp, you're right. We just always had a whole pool of people to draw from. But I want to just tell you that God is just as concerned about your kids having the influence of older godly kids in their lives as he was for us. So pray for those kind of people. Look for those kind of people. Get ready to buy Starbucks cards to bribe them. Whatever you need to have them involved in your kids' life, it's worth the time.
Because our kids are not wise enough to make good decisions when they're younger. When Carrie was 14, she snuck out to go on a date with a 18-year-old slime ball from our church. So we decided to end that relationship and rest his soul. But we made sure that did not happen anymore. That relationship was a one-date situation. And when Carrie turned 16, I'll never forget, she said, "Thanks so much for ending that relationship. I wasn't mature enough back then to make that decision." You know, again, our kids don't often give us input at the time. Our kids never said, "Oh, thank you for grounding me. Oh, thanks for not letting me, oh, you have so much more wisdom." They never said, "Would you open the word one more time, Dad, today before we go to bed? Just keep doing the right thing." Then help them embrace sacrifice over entitlement. We are living in an entitlement-driven culture. And it's no surprise that our children that we're raising as entitled are dissatisfied when they get married, because we've raised them to have everything they want and to always be right and to never have hardship. That's how we've raised them. And then we're shocked when they get married and it doesn't work out as easily.
In fact, these are interesting times we live in, because we're now 3 decades from the introduction of the self-esteem movement. Some of you know exactly what I'm talking about, especially if you're in teaching. You know, it was the early 80s that they introduced into the school system. Kids need to be told that they're the center of the universe, basically. So they did away with individual prizes for soccer. Everybody got a trophy just for showing up for soccer, right? Nobody is going to... You don't keep score at games when children are under the age of, 16, because then some lose and some win. We don't want anybody to think that they've lost. And so we've spent 3 decades telling every child raised in American culture that they're the center of their own universe, that nobody's really better than them. They are at the top of the pile. And interestingly, these guys are getting married now. So you have 2 centers of the universe colliding in the landscape of marriage, and they don't know what to do with it, except try to convince the other one that they're not the center of the universe, because that position has already been granted. And it's actually kind of scary. With the average age of marriage being 27.2, you've had a lot of years to believe that life is about me. And I just want to tell you that if you're not extremely intentional with your kids, the messages of the culture, even if you're intent to help them not believe they're the center of the universe, they will internalize that they are. And I'll just tell you, the short answer is we believe that the only real antidote to entitlement is service. Jesus said, "I came to serve, not to be served." We're on the journey towards Christ-likeness. We want to be more Christ-like in our marriage. We want our children to fall in love with Christ so that they'll be more Christ-like. And I'll just tell you, there's no better way to move them towards that than to teach them the joy of serving. And we have to be practical and in the dirt about it, if you don't mind me saying. I can remember having the children grow up here when they were really little, that before they were old enough, like by age 5 or 6, to run the play yard or the nursery, they would take aluminum cans out of the trash cans because we believed in Mother Earth. Is that what you said we were supposed to do? Because there weren't 2 different trash cans then. So the girls and I would go around during small group Bible study time, and we'd be pulling cans out of the trash cans so that we could recycle them, because we wanted them to know that they were part of the solution and that it was a great thing to serve. And that took so many different forms through the years, but it was always a huge part of our life. By the time they were teenagers, we started family missions trips. The first one we went on was to Haiti. And there was nothing that rocked all of our worlds more than spending 8 days in the 4th poorest country in this world and having mothers offer us their babies, because they knew that their child had a much better chance of survival to beat the 50% infant mortality rate, or to have a longer life than 42 years in Haiti, life expectancy. By the time our girls were college age, all three of them wrote their essay for their applications on how Haiti changed their life. And none of us have been the same since then, and none of us have ever settled back into life as it was before then. There's tremendous benefit and health and necessity for us in our families as we're preparing our children for long-term decisions that will fulfill their purposes, their God-given purposes, their God-appointed purposes in this world, than teaching them the joy of serving.
And some of us may not be able to go to Haiti or do some big thing, but they need to see that serving is a great thing, that sacrifice is the way we love people. And let me go back. Part of the reason we struggle with this is we're so daggone busy. One of the great ways you can demonstrate this as families is you have people in your church that are sick, that are disabled, that can't get out, elderly. Bake meals for them. Oh, we can't. We're too busy. Well, then get less busy. Start getting rid of the things that are not critical so that you can demonstrate serving, and go deliver food. Don't send a coupon. That doesn't help your kids. Have your kids walk up and deliver the food, hopefully. And the last thing, it sounds like our kids, speaking of, are ready for us, is help them understand commitment and covenant. People obviously are bailing on marriages, but we're bailing on marriages partially because we believe we should be happy. We've talked about that. And we can just quit if something isn't going easy. And again, I hate to say it, but we've taught our kids that. Oh, you don't like piano? Well, then we'll just stop. You don't like playing t-ball with your team? I know we said it was all year, but that's fine. If you don't want, we don't want you to be unhappy. Make your kids unhappy. Make them keep a covenant. Make them keep a commitment. Say before they start, if you start this, you stay in it. Don't let them drop out of college because I don't like it. You stay in this thing. We paid for this semester. You hang in there. We have just gotten in this thing. We want our kids not to ever be uncomfortable, be happy. Marriage is uncomfortable. Marriage makes you unhappy. At times. And even with the children, I'm going to close with this. And I don't have my notes on this tonight, unfortunately. But sometime, look at 1 Corinthians 13. And what is that called? It's the love chapter. I don't know why that's read at marriages. Have you ever thought about it? Love is what? Patient. Why does it say it's patient? Because your spouse is going to drive you nuts. Love is kind. Why? Because you're going to want to strangle them. Love is, you read every one of those, and it's because you're marrying somebody who is a sinner. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you that because you knew we're sinners, that you sacrificed so that we could be your children. Help us to live as those who sacrifice for each other, as a model in our marriages for our kids. And help us to teach them the joy of sacrificial living and loving. In Christ's name, amen.